Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question-and-answer session, please press star one. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Reggie McKinney. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you, operator, and welcome to today's CQ Voluntary Program webinar on the nexus of physical and cybersecurity. Again, my name is Reggie McKinney, and I serve as the program manager for the Department of Homeland Security CQ Voluntary Program. As always, we're glad to have you here with us today on our discussion about how physical security and cybersecurity teams can work better together to achieve stronger security organization-wide resilience. So before we begin the webinar, I'd like to, as always, thank my co-host, Doug DePep from the Regional Consortium Coordinating Council, or RC3, and Teresa Massé from the State, Local, Tribal, and Territorial Governments Coordinating Council, or SLTTGCC. They both played an integral role in organizing today's program, so thank you both, Doug and Teresa. I'll pass the mic over to them in a moment, but first I'll say a quick word about the CQ Voluntary Program. As you may know, CQ served as the Department of Homeland Security's focal point for cybersecurity outreach to critical infrastructure. We promote tools, resources, and best practices that can help organizations strengthen their cybersecurity and risk management. So if you haven't already, please sign up for our monthly bulletin. It's the easiest way to stay on top of upcoming events, as well as great new resources from the government and our private sector partners. You can sign up by visiting our website and scrolling down to subscribe to alerts. So while you're on the website, please check out a few of our resources. You're going to learn quite a bit about a few DHO's resources on today's program, and you can find links to them all as well on our website. You can also download a whole suite of other resources to help you analyze and strengthen your cybersecurity programs. For example, you can download the NIST Cybersecurity Framework Implementation Guidance for a variety of sectors. We also provide the Cyber Resilience Review, a no-cost cybersecurity assessment that you can perform yourself or request in person. And we'll talk more about DHS assessments later on. So I'm going to leave it at that for now. Thank you for being here today, and I hope you enjoy today's program. So I'm going to turn it over to Doug DePep, who will say a few words about RC3. Doug, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Reggie. Yeah, I'll introduce RC3, or the Regional Consortium Coordinating Council. It is one of the four cross-sector partnership councils recognized by DHS in the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, or NIP. With a focus on regionally based issues and concerns, RC3 members strive to connect, enable, and foster public-private partnerships for the protection, security, resilience of critical infrastructure within communities across the nation. Increasingly, capacity building in cyber is engaging cities and communities in activities and information sharing, such as the work of the ISAO Standards Organization that is enabling ISAO to begin standing up. This capacity growth is consistent with the mission of RC3. with over 30 member organizations representing 37 states and 10 metropolitan areas, RC3 is a network of networks that provides access to information sharing, subject matter expertise, the exchange of best practices, and provides a direct interface with every level of government, particularly with DHS, Office of Infrastructure Protection. RC3 specializes in facilitating dialogue through its membership meetings, themed webinar series like this with our partners, and working groups and committees. These fora foster a collaborative environment to address key issues and concerns to build and enhance regional security and resilience capabilities in a couple of ways, by supporting and encouraging cooperative public-private infrastructure protection and security activities between and among industry, federal, state, local governments, So that's the intersection of public and private. And by coordinating processes for implementing the two-way sharing of actionable information pertaining to physical and cyber threats, vulnerabilities, incidents, and potential protective measures among council members and networks to better manage risk, very consistent with the ISOW mission space. So that's a brief introduction of who RC3 is and how it's part of the NIP and what its functions are under the NIP. Next, I'll turn it over to Teresa Messay, who will give us a brief update on the SLTTGCC and also kick off today's panel discussion. Teresa?
Thank you, Doug. Appreciate that introduction. I'm Teresa Messay. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the Port of Portland and formerly the CISO for the State of Oregon. So this gives you a little bit of background on the SLTTGCC, State, Local, Tribal, Territorial Government Coordinating Council. So SLTTG governments are vital to protecting critical infrastructure and ensuring the resilience of the communities they serve. Formed in April of 2007 and reaffirmed by the Department of Homeland Security and the National Infrastructure Protection Plan, or the NIP, in 2013, Partnering for Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience, the State, Local, Tribal, and Territorial Government Coordinating Council serves as a flagship council, leveraging the expertise of these officials to bring the SLTT government's perspective into the national critical infrastructure planning process. Its members represent 24 jurisdictions across all 10 regions. Full council members include representatives of 10 states, 5 counties, 7 cities, and 2 tribes. The SLTTGCC's alliance network connects additional SLTT government practitioners from across the nation who participate in council projects and initiatives. As a national representative of the SLTT government, the council is a valuable forum for coordinating with DHS and other government entities across geographic boundaries and all levels of government. So with that, I am delighted for the opportunity to introduce our three guests speakers today on the topic of the nexus of physical and cybersecurity. So in today's discussion, we'll be learning the benefits of physical and cybersecurity teams working together and the necessity of the two critical professions syncing their efforts to achieve organizational security. So our first speaker, we are very fortunate. We have three experts today with us who will speak to this topic from a variety of perspectives. And our first guest speaker is Mark Dabena, who is the Vice President for Security at Tampa Bay Port Authority, which is Florida's largest commercial seaport. Mark has over 34 years of sworn law enforcement experience in the state of Florida, with over 20 years combined law enforcement and security management experience. Mark has extensive experience organizing and directing investigations, special events, and security details. Mark, thank you for being with us today. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Teresa. And it's my pleasure for being here today, and I want to thank you all at the beginning for allowing me to participate in this discussion. As Teresa stated, my background is in law enforcement and traditional physical security. However, by necessity, I've had to familiarize myself with the cybersecurity problem facing nearly all of our critical infrastructure in the United States and beyond. As a member of the SLTTGCC, Teresa and I regularly talk on the topic of cybersecurity. Teresa chairs our cybersecurity subcommittee, and I've learned a lot through my participation on this committee. I am by no means a tech-type person. I'm a traditional physical security person, but I understand that I cannot function in today's security environment without a working knowledge of the technical side of things. I also participate in a number of other committees that tackle this subject on a state and national level, including my position as co-chair of the American Association of Port Authorities Security Subcommittee. Through my participation with these various groups and related public-private sector groups, I've come to realize that there was a separation of resources and talent in many organizations in the area of cybersecurity. I knew this was an issue, but it really hit home to me when I was asked to speak about cybersecurity at a conference with multiple session tracks. While I was speaking on the topic of cybersecurity, in the next room, there was a physical security presentation going on. I thought it was very odd that I would be speaking on the subject of cybersecurity instead of actually being in the physical security session, let alone also being presenting on the subject. So to a lot of you, you may find some of what I'm going to say today very basic or common sense, but I continue to see in the many different things I participate in the similar issues with multiple critical infrastructure sectors and organizations. Next slide, please. As you can see, the Department of Homeland Security identifies 16 critical infrastructure sectors whose assets and systems, networks, physical or virtual, are considered to be vital to the United States. So these, you know, the DHS considers these important. Our state of Florida Critical Infrastructure Focus Group struggles with the vastness of the critical infrastructure landscape, often trying to prioritize what we would call, quote unquote, the critical of the critical. But in reality, these sectors all exist because they are important in our daily lives in one way or another. Incapacitation or destruction of these assets would have a debilitating effect on national security, the national economy, national public health or safety, and any combination thereof. Following the tragic events of 9/11, critical infrastructure spent literally billions of dollars hardening all types of critical infrastructure sites against physical attacks. But the threat of cyber attacks has caused a shift in thinking. Our cyber assets rely more and more on cyber asset. Our critical infrastructure relies more and more on cyber assets to function. Terrorist organizations, traditional organized crime, lone wolf hackers, and foreign governments all have an interest in understanding and exploiting our critical infrastructure weaknesses for various reasons. Next slide, please. So why is critical infrastructure a good place to study partnerships like we're talking about today? First of all, many of our critical infrastructure facilities operate in a highly regulated environment to include cybersecurity requirements. A security breach, whether physical or cyber, has the same negative consequence. It can be regulatory sanctions, civil litigation, or loss of reputation. There are various forms of automation at all levels of sophistication of infrastructure facilities. In my world, the port world, there's a famous saying, you've seen one port. And I have to believe that translates into many different facilities across sectors. Understanding those sometimes complex interdependencies requires a multi-discipline approach. Mitigation strategies for cybersecurity include a physical and cyber component. While the cloud offers some separation from physical location, most critical infrastructure sites have vast amounts of cyber infrastructure on site, and that can include fiber, cyber, server rooms, etc. Many critical infrastructure facilities are exposed to international cyber threats as a nature of their business. Off-site call centers, manufacturing facilities, business offices, and customers in foreign countries necessitate the need to be connected globally. Next slide, please. So we all had shared traditional roles in the past that kind of kept us apart, and some of those roles, at least on my side at the beginning, were the three G's, we used to call it, guards, gates, and guns. And traditional IT security involved devices and network separation, among other methods. This created an environment where there appeared to be little necessity for collaboration. There is a history here that we will discuss. As noted earlier, today's world requires close coordination by both disciplines. There now exists common ground where these professionals can come together, including our contractors. Next slide, please. So what were the traditional impediments to success? In many traditional corporate and public entities, management structures, traditional physical security operations, and IT departments reported to separate chains of commands. In my organization, for example, IT reported to the chief financial officer, while security reported to the chief of operations. In response to these emerging threats, our CEO flattened the reporting structure and brought IT and security together under the executive office. These traditional reporting structures can create silos, a separation that hinders an alignment of priorities, and a lack of understanding of common problems. Turf and money often go hand in hand, as IT and security are often viewed as non-revenue generating. Both entities struggle to justify requests for additional resources. In some cases, the regulators focus on one area more than another, but we should all be reminded that it is the organization as a whole that suffers if regulatory violations and associated sanctions occur. Finally, traditional IT departments do not, as a matter of routine, interact with law enforcement, while security departments often rely on these close relationships with law enforcement to achieve their goals. Next slide, please. So with that, I offer some common ground. We share space and interest in protecting that space. In some cases, it's camera infrastructure. It could be alarms. It could be access control systems. It could be external utility boxes. These systems require IT support, but also protect IT's infrastructure. In the case of a server room, you might have cameras that are actually watching that room. You might have an access control system that's protecting its contents. In the case of external fiber connections, there are vaults that are out in the field that need to be guarded, both through physical locking mechanisms and also through routine patrols. Interdependencies, security technology that often rides on networks managed by IT. These systems are not only necessary to the security function, may also be incorporated in a facility security plan that is required and enforced by a regulator. So in our particular case, as an example, as a port, we have to file a security plan with the Coast Guard. Part of that plan would be that our cameras are part of our security function. If those cameras have to go down, we have to supplement those cameras with expensive guards or other measures until the cameras can come back up. So in the same vein, shared regulators, the Coast Guard now has cybersecurity requirements as part of our physical security plans. So it requires both myself and the Chief Information Officer to work together to assure that our plans are being enforced. We share the same customers, sometimes for different reasons, but our employees and management in our facilities and in our organizations are shared customers, and therefore we have a shared interest in making sure that they are able to work in a secure and safe environment. We have common adversaries, as I mentioned in the beginning. The traditional terrorists certainly would love to plan attacks over the Internet. It expedites their planning and is a lot less expensive than actually bringing a physical attack to a scene. And those common adversaries, such as organized crime and others, are attacking our systems daily. Neither discipline is recognized as a revenue generator. So this gives us an opportunity to pool resources and make joint requests for resources. Finally, and I'll talk a little bit about this more in a second, the necessity to work together in criminal cases. There's no way that if we are attacked that we can be successful without both groups being involved. There are individual expertise in both disciplines that allow the physical security people to help with collection of evidence and also expert testimony and help with terminology. Next slide, please. With that, I want to give a little bit of information or comment on common misconceptions about law enforcement and confidentiality. A lot of times we hear that it's not in the best interest of an organization to work with law enforcement because some of your proprietary information or practices may be exposed through some type of discovery process. I can't say that law enforcement has come a long way in this area and understands that need for confidentiality and takes measures while they're doing their investigation to help support that confidentiality as much as possible. Further, I think there's a common misconception that law enforcement would take your system down in order to gather evidence. We've had cases in our own organization, and that was not the case. We were able to gather evidence and give them information without affecting the performance of our system or having to take it down. There's also a common misperception out there about a lack of expertise by regulators. An example of that would be the Coast Guard, as I said before, and maybe in a criminal case, the FBI. My experience is that these types of organizations have become very savvy in cybersecurity from the standpoint that they may have traditional investigators coming in at the beginning of a case to gather initial information about an intrusion or security breach. But further on into the investigation, they have competent experts in their fields that come in and get into the more detailed part of the case. Finally, especially in private industry, there's a concern about competitive advantage. And this is mainly an issue with management, that they may lose competitive advantage because of bad press or the fact that some of their proprietary information may get out. Again, law enforcement has matured in this area and is sensitive to those issues and tries to mitigate them as much as possible. Next slide, please. So bridges for success, again, sounds pretty simple, but you don't see as much of this as you think you would. The first one would be joint training opportunities. In our local area, there is an electronic crimes task force that's sponsored by the Secret Service, and both myself and the CIO attend those meetings. We've also, in our American Association of Port Authority subcommittees, we've had joint meetings between the IT subcommittee and the security subcommittee. Information sharing, certainly through emails, we share information on things that we think are of interest to each other, and I take information from the SLTT GCC and give it to IT, and they do that vice versa for me on other things. But we also have regularly scheduled meetings where we work on project issues and include time for contractors on both sides. I think that's important. A lot of our security and IT processes are done in partnership with contractors, and we try to include them as much as possible when appropriate. Joint funding opportunities, we look for ways to pool funds from our respective budgets internally so that if we're doing a big project, part of the funding might come from me to do certain types of IT infrastructure while IT department would come in and bring in other sources of funding to complete the project. Externally, in our committee, the SLTT GCC has looked at this. There are grant applications in the State Homeland Security Grant Program, Port Security Program, and other grant opportunities where cybersecurity is a priority. And a lot of times the IT departments aren't aware of these grant funding opportunities. They're more focused to the traditional physical security providers. I think we all share a common function as a rule enforcer. Both disciplines promulgate and enforce rules that are often unpopular with the people that have to follow them. And so they can often impact not only our internal co-employees and managers, but external customers. So by speaking with one voice, we help each other with rule enforcement, and often we also try to provide training at the same time so that the other people involved in our organizations understand the nexus between physical and cybersecurity. And with that, I'd like to thank you for listening to my presentation, and I think we're going to hold questions till later on.
Thank you, Mark. This is Teresa. That was very insightful. It's always interesting to hear what somebody has from a practical experience within their own organization, as well as your comments about how law enforcement is changing how they think about working with folks in cyber. So really appreciated you sharing your thoughts and comments on that. I'm sure there'll be plenty of questions for you coming up. So next, I am delighted to introduce Patrick Miller, who has dedicated his career to the protection and defense of critical infrastructure. As managing partner at Archer Security Group, he is a trusted independent security and regulatory advisor for industrial control systems worldwide. He also is the founder, director, and president emeritus of EnergySec, as well as the U.S. coordinator for the Industrial Cybersecurity Center. Patrick's diverse background spans energy, telecommunications, water, and financial services. Patrick, thank you for being with us today. We look forward to hearing from you. Do we have Patrick on the line? Maybe he's muted.
Please check your mute button. If you are on the line, Patrick, please press star zero.
Teresa, this is Harley. Do you want me to start?
Yeah, sorry. Maybe we'll...
One moment, please. I show him on the line. One moment. Hi, Patrick. Your line is open.
Oh, great. Thank you. All right. How's my audio?
Sounds good. Thanks, Patrick.
Hey, Fantastic. Sorry, we had a mute issue there. The star six was failing to untoggle. All right. Fantastic presentation, Mark. Thank you so much. I'm going to say some of the same things you said, unfortunately, but that's a good thing. That means, in theory, great minds think alike. Okay, and next slide, please. Okay, so there was a day back when it was guards, gates, and guns for the physical space, and it was pretty much, you know, the worst thing in your world was your key management program. It's gone to a stage where pretty much everything that we do for either cyber or physical security is all digital. It's difficult to find analog equipment anywhere unless it's mechanical, and that's your locks. And even some of our locks have gone digital. So the challenge we've got now is it's kind of all just merging together, and there's more of a focus and a discipline more towards cyber or more towards physical. But as mentioned, you know, our disciplines are really kind of bleeding together, and the Venn diagram is a much higher degree of overlap today than it did in the past, and it's going to continue to get further and further aligned as we go through. There'll still be some focus areas, you know, for more toward physical or more toward cyber, but there's going to be a significant amount of our lives that have a strong overlap. It's the classic case of, in the cyberspace, we all joke about the fact that you don't get cybersecurity unless you have physical security, because if they can get their hands on the device, it's game over. Well, it's turning around that it's almost the same way in the physical side. The cybersecurity of those physical systems, your physical access control systems in particular and some of the other areas, the cybersecurity of those physical systems now is critical, almost in the same way that the physical security of the cyber systems is. Next slide, please. So as we go forward, we've got a lot of innovation in our space. There is an enormous amount of new technology for both cyber and physical. Some of the stuff that I'm seeing in the physical space is mind-blowing, but again, it's all digital. I think some of the challenges we're going to see around this degree of innovation is we're going to innovate so fast that we didn't think about securing the security devices in ways that are meaningful or realistic. If you deploy some new physical security technology and that technology is hackable and it's hard to patch, it's hard to actually maintain a standard cybersecurity lifecycle for your physical security equipment, that's going to be challenging. So we're looking at some of those areas, at least as far as the pace of innovation and the degree of rigor that goes into the technologies that we're deploying. The other part of this is, you know, we're trying to secure things that are mobile. The mobility of these elements makes it very challenging from a security standpoint. Now, the other part of that is the size. The physical size, the footprint of a lot of the things you're trying to secure from a technology standpoint, if you're trying to secure access to a device, for example. The devices, they're not only in some cases moving around, but some cases they're getting so small that they're very hard to see. It's eventually going to just kind of work its way into the fabric. So the challenges of just kind of the standard technology trajectory are going to create some physical security challenges around making sure that those devices, you know, they're always in the right hands or they're, you know, protected from the wrong hands. Next slide, please. So we've got a state where as we move toward technology for all of these things, whether it's cyber or physical, we're going to end up with a lot of data. And that's a good thing. You want a lot of data because the more data you've got coming from your environment, the better kind of operational picture you're going to get, the more realistic you're going to get. So, you know, if you can track a lot more, you know, badge entries, for example, or camera points, whatever it might be, that gives you a much wider perspective and a much richer picture of what's going on out there in your environment. So the good thing is that, you know, the operational kind of security data is now going to be coming from every device because every device you buy is going to be technology element. Now it's going to be digital, which means it will create data. So what used to just be a bunch of, you know, mechanical or physical elements, as they move more toward the digital elements, they're going to generate data streams. This is good, but this also creates kind of an aggregation point. And, you know, the old Willie Sutton, arguably it was Willie Sutton or wasn't, but nonetheless is kind of his axiom still holds is they asked him why he robs banks, and he says because that's where the money is. Well, data is money, and operational security data can be more than money. It's access to everything in a lot of cases. So that operational security data now becomes a fairly large target. So as we move this direction, we get the value out of that data, but so do the adversaries. And securing that operational security data is critical. Next slide, please. So the next piece of this is we get all this data from all the devices. How do you get kind of a common operational picture, a single pane of glass? It's challenging. So some of the more, I guess, progressive areas I'm seeing is we're looking at integrating the cybersecurity information, the cybersecurity telemetry, if you will, with the physical security telemetry, and then rendering that so that security teams, in a lot of cases, combined security teams or converged security teams can work together. So I'll give you an example of this is, say, for instance, Patrick badges into a facility and logs into a different facility that are about 100 miles apart geographically, and it's done within maybe minutes. And there's logic in the system that can tell you that's physically impossible for me to badge into one system and log into another system 100 miles away within that span of time. It's just not possible. So there are now algorithms and techniques we can use now to merge the physical security data and the cybersecurity data to help you really understand that overall picture in ways we've never been able to do before. But the goal now is to get as much data as you can, converge that data, and then present the common operational picture to a converged team. That's the forward trajectory that we want to be on. Next slide, please. And, you know, Mark, you mentioned this in yours. 1982 called, and they want their organizational structure back. I mean, we cannot go forward with the separate cybersecurity components and the physical security components. I must say your executives are astute in the fact that they created an organizational structure where cyber and physical were peers and reported to the executive layer. And they're outside of the business. They're outside of the influence of any of the other areas that creates, you know, no conflict of interest, and it takes security seriously. These elements, you know, as we go forward, if they're not done that way, they will languish with the ability to get, you know, converged funding, operational impact, you know, organizational impact, and then overall security effectiveness and efficiencies. This is by far the most effective way to take security seriously and demonstrate that. We've seen in situations where cyber insurance claims have been put forth. Even things like the organizational structure matter with what you get back in your return because you effectively have to show due diligence. And if it looks like you've buried security and you haven't taken security seriously, then it's very difficult to even get insurance or you know, claim any sort of file a claim if you actually want to. So we have to look at this from an organizational standpoint, and it's got to start at the top. And I know that message is said every time, but from a security standpoint, again, if you're not taking it seriously, then it's going to be very evident. Next slide, please. So in closing, the reality is we're basically in the same boat. You know, we're really the two great tastes that go great together. It's been traditional that we've kind of done our own thing. It's no longer an effective approach. We've got to merge the teams, get a fair understanding of what both sides are doing. The physical security folks should get some cybersecurity awareness and some understanding, and the cybersecurity folks should get just as much physical security awareness and understanding so that those teams can work together hand in hand. The approach where the merged and the converged security approach is so much more effective that it's really just orders of magnitude. And when you participate in one of those programs, you can really see that difference. But they need to share everything. You know, there's no more organizational silos. They share their information. They should share their tactics. They should share their data, their staff, their tools. All of these things should effectively kind of be shared and converged. You can spend a lot of money on that and, you know, create some very elaborate tool sets, or you can really just go to coffee, you know, or a beer and get these teams together and have them converge in ways that are meaningful, because if they don't have that human relationship element, it's going to be even more difficult for them to cross those disciplines. So get everyone together and kind of get them all facing in the same direction and converge these teams for success. And that's it.
Thank you, Patrick.
You bet.
That was great. I really appreciated your emphasis on the importance of sharing data and how that's valuable to both physical security professionals as well as cybersecurity professionals, and working together is really valuable to the overall organization. You really can't work in silos anymore, and I think that's really important for people to try to grasp. Particularly for professions that tended to be very different and didn't have a history of working well together. So thank you for sharing those thoughts. Appreciate it. Our final guest speaker is Harley Reinerson. He's a cybersecurity advisor, or CSA, with the Department of Homeland Security. Harley is the CSA for Region 8, which includes Colorado, Montana, North and South Dakota, Utah, and Wyoming. Harley's credentials include a Master's of Military Arts and Science from the United States Army Command and General Staff College, and a Master of Business Administration from Colorado State University. Harley, thank you for being with us today. We look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you, Teresa. And to kind of echo Mark and Patrick's direction, I'm going to just kind of talk about our overall physical and cyber collaborative relationship. And so, as Teresa said, my name's Harley Reinerson. I'm calling in from snowy Colorado, and I'm going to briefly touch on the relationships between the physical and cyber components of Homeland Security. Next slide, please. So, I know there's a number of people that are on the telephone, so I'll probably talk to some of these slides at the deference of the people that can see them. But what we're going to probably take a look at is how is critical infrastructure viewed from a Homeland Security perspective? And so reading from that slide, systems and assets, whether physical or virtual, are so vital to the destruction of such areas that have a impact on the security and economic, public health, and safety environment that they cross all federal, state, regional, and local jurisdictions. And that comes out of the National Infrastructure Protection Plan. So basically what it amounts to is with all these, we pretty much cover all infrastructure to include governmental and private. Next slide, please. So what do? We focus, DHS basically focuses on critical infrastructure key resources across all 16 sectors. And it's worthwhile to take up and you know, do a quick search and figure out what sectors they are, but they include such things as energy, transportation, healthcare, financial, nuclear power plants, all, you know, pretty much almost everything out there. The state, local, tribal, and territorial governments pretty much cross a lot of these sectors and are really key in providing a lot of times the law enforcement, medical, and fire support to our nation's citizens. So there's a hand-in-glove kind of aspect, if you will, between critical infrastructure and governmental entities down to the local level. DHS, we're out in the field, and we provide assistance to a lot of these governmental partners. And as you can see, or those that can see on the slide, you know, we try and identify, build and maintain relationships, and collaborate. That's kind of one of our main focuses, is to provide and build the relationships between all these separate and disparate entities. So why is DHS in the community? Next slide, please. And so what it amounts to is we're trying to provide resiliency, assistance for organizations to build their own resiliency. And like, say, the official definition is the ability to prepare for and adapt to changing conditions and withstand and recover rapidly from disruptions. Resiliency includes the ability to withstand and recover from deliberate attacks, accidents, and naturally occurring threats and incidences. You know, basically, it's like what's shown there is as a spring. You know, you have to be able to spring back and sustain and, you know, be able to recover from bad events. Next slide, please. One of the key points is most of the critical infrastructure is privately owned, and so we do not, from a DHS perspective, have legal authority to regulate. There's, you know, limited compliance capabilities within DHS and other agencies. However, we do have a major role and responsibility in the overall critical infrastructure protection. How do we, you know, how do we address those challenges? Next slide, please. So DHS has a couple of programs out there. The Protective Security Advisor Program, they're called PSAs, and the Cybersecurity Advisor Program, CSAs. And so they are the linkage and the field forces that DHS provides to all the organizations as well as, you know, critical infrastructure organizations as well as governmental entities within the nation. And they're basically trained PSAs as well as CSAs to take a look at vulnerability management, take a look at the and coordinate with other Homeland Security offices, which include, you know, the INA, the intelligence organizations, as well as other organizations such as the FBI and Secret Service, to provide assistance as best we can to the organizations across the board. Bottom line is, you know, PSAs and CSAs assess both the physical and cyber risk for the critical infrastructure and the SLTT governments. Next slide, please. As you can see, the or as some of you can see, there are approximately 112 PSAs nationwide, and they've been in the field for over 10 years. However, we're only at approximately 12 cybersecurity advisors nationwide, but we're hiring 10 more as we speak, and we, you know, provide and link up with the PSAs in, you know, all the regions and territories and tribal organizations as needed. Next slide, please. So one of the components I can't not talk about one of our missions, which is the NCIC mission, which is the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center, and that's a 24/7 capability. And they mitigate incidents across critical infrastructure and SLTT. You know, there's approximately, you know, 100 screens and people available in D.C. that are monitoring the health and welfare of the nation's overall cyber capabilities. You know, the transmission. You know, everything that's up there. We also have a number of different, you know, private sector organizations that sit on the floor that also assist in providing assistance and mitigating issues that crop up on a daily and hourly basis. One of those types of capabilities and services, next slide, please, is the Hunt and Incident Response Team. They call it the HURT team. That is a flyaway capability that is able to go to major issues and are able to provide, you know, basically incident management as well as analysis from, you know, malware analysis and all sorts of types of analysis that is a reach-back capability from the incident site that assists in mitigating and resolving those types of issues. There are a number of other assessments that we provide, and we can you know, get into those on a case-by-case basis. Next slide, please. And so this is my contact information. If there's other questions that you have, which I'm sure you may have, we can talk about how I can hook you up to the CSA and or PSA within your area for any additional questions, or just talk to me and we can provide you some fact sheets on the services that we provide. And, oh, by the way, they're prepaid services, which means free to you. They're paid through taxes. And, you know, they provide a lot of assessment services from strategic down to technical and tactical levels. So thank you very much, and I believe we're going to go into a Q&A period. So back to you, Teresa.
Thank you, Harley. It's always great to hear the federal government is taking a leadership role in providing both cyber and physical security activities, and the resources you mentioned are extremely helpful. And as you noted, you know, they are free, although nothing's free, but through taxes, but free to both the public and private sector, and I think that's really great. And hopefully through this webinar and all the good work that you and your colleagues are doing, more folks will be aware of them and taking advantage of them. So thank you so much. Okay, so I want to thank Martha Bina and Patrick Miller and Harley Reinerson for providing valuable insight on this important topic. But before we begin our question and answer portion, I'll turn it back over to Reggie McKinney for some housekeeping reminders. Reggie?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you, Teresa. So if you have a question during this discussion, please type it in the chat box, and our representatives will either respond directly or pass questions on to our panelists. excuse me. At the end of the moderated discussion, we will also ask the operator to open up the lines to take questions over the phone. We hope you will also stick around to take our very short survey, which we'll pull up on the screen during the audience Q&A portion. So if you have further feedback, we encourage you to reach out to us via email at rcqvp@hq.dhs.gov mailbox. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to Teresa for the discussion.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it, Reggie. So got some questions just in advance of taking questions from the audience for our panelists. So, Mark, I'd like to start with you. What impediments remain in your efforts to create bridges between IT and security departments?
Thanks, Teresa. I think the biggest challenge we face is that we still have limited resources, and, you know, that old saying, we have our day jobs, so we're working together. We still have all these other functions that are going on the side that are key to what we do in our mission. And I don't think the customers really see the fact that we have this joint responsibility for security. They're really more focused on what we do for them on a daily basis that they see as what's important to them. So I would say the biggest challenge we have, if you get past the personalities, which we've been very successful at, and you understand that you're in the same boat, as was said before, probably the biggest challenge is resources to work together.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense. Patrick, how can a security organization get a larger budget for improvement? Always a challenge.
Yeah, budgets are always an issue. Typically, if you go to executives, most executives, some get it, but many of them don't. And you ask, we need money for security. Typically, they hear security and they get frightened. They have some sort of visceral reaction to that. I typically, to go for budget, I talk about reducing risk instead. Talk about resilience. Talk about things that actually add business value and improve operations and improve, continuity of operations in the event of issues. Those kind of things typically resonate more with executives than saying we need to be more secure. So it's typically, the message, it's the delivery of the message and communicating it in terms of executive speak, which is, it's not that they're stupid, but they have a limited amount of time to make decisions. So you really got to kind of present it in up arrow, down arrow, smiley face, frowny face, in a very direct measure of this is going to, deliver this much loss avoidance or risk avoidance, risk protection, instead of talking about security. That word seems to not echo well in most boardrooms.
Thank you, and I think that's so true. I think when we can help executives focus on risk, which they're accustomed to hearing about because they have, they deal with risk in so many different aspects of business. You're right. I think security kind of throws them off because they think they don't know anything about security and they get frightened. So thank you. That was very helpful. So Harley, can you give us some examples of how PSAs and CSAs work together?
Sure. So basically, there's a PSA in every state, and in some states there's a couple PSAs. So they'll be out and about, and they'll get a cybersecurity question or request for an assessment, those types of things. And then they normally, come IFR direct back to the CSA and pose that question that we try and answer for the partner that we're dealing with. So that's one component. Another component would be is if, in fact, there's a, say, cybersecurity incident of some sort, they may have relationships with the locals that I do not, and people have questions on, how to report, who to report to, and when to report. And so then the PSAs will generally throw that over the fence to us.
Okay, thank you. That's good. That's good to know that you've got that good partnership working together. I'm sure people will appreciate it. So, Mark, I had a question. When planning for organization-wide security, how important is senior management buy-in?
Well, I appreciate Patrick supporting me or reiterating this position. It's imperative. And I also want to echo his comments on how you get that buy-in. First of all, if you don't have a buy-in in the C-suite, you're going to be a really rough road. And while, you know, everybody pays lip service to security, at the end of the day, it's the stuff that kind of gets hacked at the end of a budget cycle when they're trying to do their final budget. So I agree with the point that coming in as a unified force, showing them that they can actually reduce their risk, possibly reduce their insurance costs. And now they're holding boards responsible for cybersecurity incidents. So individual board members may learn that they actually have a responsibility here too and could have civil liability down the road. I think all those things are not necessarily hammers to hold over someone's head. It's just to get them rethinking their thought process about how security actually does support the bottom line through cost reduction and a number of different things, not only insurance, but lost revenue from negative incidents.
Okay. Thank you. Patrick, do you think we can slow down the deployment of all this new technology so we can secure devices, et cetera, before they go to market?
Short answer, no. We can't slow it down. We can try. We may slow it down fractionally, marginally at best. Humans have a desire to innovate. We're, you know, and frankly, if we try to slow our side down, then the rest of the world will just move faster than us. So in order to keep pace with global innovation, we're going to have to move as fast as everyone else, if not faster, if we want to maintain the edge. So that means the pace of innovation is only going to, frankly, increase because we're going to be using everything from the technology that we've innovated to innovate itself, and we'll be using artificial intelligence. We'll be doing all kinds of unique and interesting things to only make that innovation pace go faster. So the unfortunate answer is no. We're not going to be able to slow it down. It's not something that should even, you know, argue about. It's just not going to happen. So that said, you have to pick up, the mantle. It's the hard job. We got into this for a reason. We do what we do for a reason. If it was easy, somebody else would do it. So yes, it's going to be difficult, but it's what we do, and we have to be just as innovative in the way we think about new solutions and security approaches. And we can't just continue to think the old way because everything is going to innovate around us if we don't.
Thank you. Yeah, it's somewhat depressing when you're in cybersecurity or physical security professional because manufacturers tend to want to get their product to market first, and security generally tends to be an afterthought. So it certainly keeps us well employed trying to keep up and try to implement security generally after the fact, put some controls in place to try to make it a little more safer. So, Harley, what physical and cybersecurity challenges are you seeing in organizations as you and PSAs go around and work with various private and public sector organizations?
So I think you just covered it to a certain degree is, new technology, does it have security built in? And the answer, and I'll agree, was that that'll never happen. You know, first to market gets market share and, ROI. So I'm thinking that it may have an opportunity for strap-on second market security products. But to your question, when I'm looking at, ICS controls, things like this, a lot of our efforts and everything, we're kind of playing catch-up on the industrial control systems side of the house to a certain degree. There are some major, breakthroughs, but there's also just so many smaller organizations that need to take a quick look at what they have, take a look at some of the leading practices that are out there, and see if, in fact, they can, up their game. So I would think on the OT side, industrial control system side, I think that's an area where we could have some major improvement with some modicum of paying attention to the issues.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate that. Well, I want to thank again our panelists for your presentations as well as your remarks. So next I'm going to pass back to Reggie to take some questions from the audience. Reggie?
All right. Thanks, Teresa. Operator, will you please open up the phone lines?
Thank you.
Please, if anybody have any questions, the operator will give you the instructions on how to do this.
Thank you, Reggie. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You'll be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, please press star 2. One moment, please, to see if we have any questions or comments. Eric Holdeman, your line is now open.
Yeah, I asked a message in the text. I'm just wondering, as we see security and being physical security and IT having this confluence, and I was the director of security at the Port of Tacoma for 4 years, so I saw it then, but have you seen where the two have actually been merged? And I would think it would be security going into IT because of the dominance of security devices now having an IT nexus. And then I'd mentioned the issue of buying cyber insurance and involving the risk management officer in that rather than just coming out of security or IT.
This is Mark. I can take a shot at your question. I don't know if you'll see a total melding of the two in the form of one department, because I still think there, as I said in my challenges question, there's still a lot of challenges out there that where they're doing independent things that really don't have any relation to each other. But I do think that when those two entities are on equal footing and they have the support of the CEO, there's a lot of collaboration that can occur because a lot of those silos and walls get taken down. Reference to risk management, we do get included, and so does cyber, in our insurance questionnaires. So a lot of the things that we've done together in the last 18 months, including joint assessments and training, are given to our risk manager to include in our insurance questionnaires. And those things do lower your insurance. The physical side does, and so does the other efforts. And those questions get asked when you buy cyber insurance.
All right, thank you.
And again, if you do have any questions or comments, please press star 1 and record your name.
So while we wait, this is Reggie again. So while we wait, we'll take another couple of we have some questions come in from our audience. And so I'm going to throw this over the fence here. So the question is, do you normally see organizations train employees on physical security, or do they typically recruit externally for those skills?
This is Mark. I'll just shot it. Can you repeat the question, Reggie, please?
Yeah, so the question was, do you normally see organizations train employees on physical security, or do they typically recruit externally, for those skills?
Well, I think it's a combination. Some bigger organizations that have the ability to think ahead and have succession planning do, but my experience has been typically they go out and recruit the experience instead of trying to foster it internally. That would just be my experience on that.
This is Harley. I'll jump in real quickly. So I actually concur. So generally on the smaller organizations, it's at the bottom of that job description says all duties is assigned. And so what happens is that the guy that likes the IT in a 3-person shop, becomes the IT person. Next thing you know, they're a 20-person shop and then a 100-person shop. So at which point in time then it becomes somewhat unmanageable. And so I think it's a ground-up build first, and then as they mature, then they'll be able to go out and actually have, you know, HR, you know, rigor around the hiring process. And what I'd like to note also, there's a thing called the NICE framework that's out there that takes seven different types of skill sets, and there's a, I believe there's a toolkit also that helps smaller organizations develop their plan and their and the ability to identify what skill sets they need to utilize, and also some job descriptions. So that, I think that's out there also.
So I'll go to another question we got. So and you know, feel free to jump in on this. So how does SLTT and law enforcement educate the public sector companies on risk?
So this is Harley. I'll jump in real quickly too. When you say, so from the law enforcement side of the house, that actually goes back to somewhat incident management, because most state organizations and a lot of local organizations will say, if you have a cyber incident, call your local law enforcement. Well, a lot of, and most smaller law enforcement organizations do not have a capability. So they'll then refer it up to either a state fusion center, or maybe the state organization that's kind of like a state FBI to take a look at. But that tends to be more on the white collar and you know, child porn crimes is kind of where the focus is there a lot of times. But those fusion centers and those state you know, investigative guys will have linkages to the thing called the multi-state ISAC, which is supports state and local organizations, and then also to DHS. So there are a couple avenues, but sometimes I would say it depends. Depends on the issue and depends on the impact to the partner.
Hey, Reggie, this is Doug DePep from RC3. I'd like to add to the commentary about risk, and in the comments thread, there was a question about boardroom exposure, boardroom risk, liability, and insurance. So I like the conversation about looking at cyber from a risk standpoint. When I'm not working with RC3 in my coordinating counsel hat, I practice cyber law, and I think that what I want to pass along is this viewing the cyber domain also from a risk standpoint, not just from a network risk, but from an organizational risk and an exposure component, is an important consideration, because it's not just fixing the immediate problem, but then what are the downstream ramifications from a liability standpoint. And so in terms of addressing risk, there was a question about a compliance officer and a risk management officer. Counsel needs to be at the table as well, and for two reasons. One is to introduce that factor: what is the liability exposure, what's the regulatory exposure, and so on. And the second factor is that counsel can introduce privacy, attorney-client privacy, so that what emerges is not necessarily revealed to third parties. So I think that's part of the risk management team.
Operator, were there any questions over the phone?
Yes, we do have a question from Mary Sheridan. Your line is now open.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. I have really more of a comment than a question. My what I wanted to add was, that hasn't been mentioned, is the multitude of courses that are available through the consortium. I think that if more people would be aware of this, they could understand cyber when they don't. They could understand physical security if they don't. I started with, through Texas A&M, the track one, just cybersecurity for everyone. I got hooked, did track two and track three, and I understand things I never imagined I would ever understand because I'm pretty computer illiterate, and I'm actually taking the IT digital forensics right now through them, and it's all free, and there's infrastructure courses. I mean, it's a plethora of things for people to educate themselves for free through the government, through DHS. And my question is, since now I'm hooked on cybersecurity and digital forensics, how do I get into it?
This is Patrick. I'll chime in. There's plenty of jobs in cybersecurity, and forensics is I would say it's one of the more refined disciplines in security, but there's still plenty of jobs in forensics as well. And there's a lot of different investigative teams you can join to get started. We've seen several law enforcement agencies will take private citizens as potential options for volunteer work. There's lots of different, you know, other career tracks you can take it up towards, you know, through certification. I know there's very, you know, a wide range of different certificates, SANS, ISC2. There's a whole bunch of them out there as well to give you some kind of credentials, so to speak. If you're looking for something that's, you know, particularly challenging, if you wanted to try, doing forensics in the industrial control system space is probably the most challenging of all the forensics because you can't take the system down. You can't. It's got to stay up. It's got to stay running. So doing, like, live forensics on a chemical refinery or a power system is extremely challenging and exciting. But I would say right now, some of the latest statistics I've seen are around 10 to 1 jobs per person in the cybersecurity space. There's just not enough people. You could almost just kind of fall down and land in a cybersecurity job.
Thank you. What about somebody like myself who is, you know, not really a techie, but I'm finding that I do have a knack for different things. My first career, I'm a registered nurse. I was in critical care. And very good diagnostician. And I'm finding as I'm taking these courses, that is coming through in my ability to even think ahead of the course and figure out where hackings and different things are coming from without even learning it yet. So I think, you know, how can I actually, I can't afford to go back to college. So what would you recommend I do? Where's a starting point for me?
Oh, great question. The low budget approach is actually very effective. I myself went that route. The low budget approach where you don't want to have to pay for college again. And honestly, there's a lot of universities and they've got some great programs, but I found that in some cases, not in all, but in some cases, the university programs are late in the curriculum. So they're not teaching, you know, today or tomorrow's curriculum. Believe it or not, one of the better places to start a discussion and get trained is on Twitter. I know that sounds strange, but there's a very strong information security, cybersecurity group all over Twitter. You can reach out to me directly, and I can link you up with some of the standard people. But you could basically just search for cybersecurity, and you're going to get a ton of it out there. There's a lot of good, believe it or not, very good tutorials on YouTube on learning different technologies. But it's not so much about the technologies. It's about the way you think. I mean, if you think the right way or you think like a hacker, it's going to be easier to catch a hacker. Ultimately, the best defense against a hacker is another person, not technology. Pick your technology that you like to work on and work on securing that. There's going to be a need for that. But the main thing is if you're of the right mindset and you're diligent and you've got a good nose, you know, for detecting malice, you're going to do well in security. It's just you don't necessarily have to be ultra technical to get into cybersecurity.
Right. Okay, thank you very much.
And we do have a question from Chuck Huffman. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I work for an international large company, and we have our own cyber defense center in Europe. But I'm in a chemical production plant. And is there value to contacting Homeland Security? And I don't want to be scrambling around if I have an incident. So is it a value to make those contacts and to have a standard SOP and contacts and everything already in place so that when an incident or an issue happens that you've already got systems, people to contact and everything in place? And would you start with your local city department, or would you suggest contacting Homeland Security and setting those contacts and things up, and maybe even putting together a practice session once a year or so, as a just like our fire and gas brigade responds with the local fire department, set up a test run through, shall we say, or something along those lines.
So this is Harley. I'll jump in real quick. What state are you at?
State of Missouri, Kansas City.
Kansas City. So you got a Jeff Renza that I can hook you up with as the CSA in that area. Additionally, I would assume that you have, if you're in that chemical side of the house, there's chemical inspectors. Do you know your chemical inspector from DHS?
Yeah, I believe I met him because he came in and did a full audit survey assessment.
Okay.
And
so go ahead, sir.
We actually had a group from Europe come in of cyber hackers. So we started on penetration testing and things along that line 5 years ago. So we've had a chance to progress down the roadways quite a little ways as far as internal. But like I said, even though we've did those assessments, it's not a one and done. It's a continuous improvement process. You have to be on it all the time. And so part of that is, once you get past the major issues that you identify and remediate, then it's into making sure you have the documentation in place so that when something goes wrong, there's something to go to. And then you need to make sure you have systems in place and documented so that nobody stands around looking up in the sky going, oh, my God, what do I do now?
So to answer your question, yes, I think, our price is right. It's free. The local CSA can take a look at your security program and give you some input in that. And you're correct. It is a lifestyle. It's not a one and done.
Thank you.
I show no further questions.
Okay. So this is Reggie again. So I saw a couple of questions come across earlier about utilizing the various DHS tools and resources to institute in your own training programs, and if it was okay to incorporate those. Absolutely. All the tools and resources that we do have on our website, and we make those available to everyone. We make them available to federal, to critical infrastructure, to private sector, and to small and medium sized businesses. So please feel free to incorporate any of the resources and the tools that we have on our website. And certainly contact us if you have any questions. So there were a couple of other questions that they came across. And so one of the questions, I'll put it out to the group, was what measures are being taken to hold utility companies accountable and keeping infrastructure secure? So if somebody wants to take that.
Yeah, I'll take that one. I was a regulator for the electric sector. This is Patrick. At least the electric space, the gas space in ports, there are some regulations out there already for kind of a base level security. I mean, the cybersecurity professionals would call it a low bar. It's still a difficult bar to meet for an infrastructure company because ICS is an interesting thing to try to secure. So there are some measures already being taken. They are kind of the "you must be this tall to ride the ride" approach from an elite cybersecurity perspective, but it's still something. By and large, the infrastructure components are disparate. They're not similar. They're, you know, and in a lot of cases, not all, but they're not connected to the internet. They're isolated. So there's, you know, just kind of standard practice. But you'll find most utilities, they deal with these kind of things, not necessarily attacks every day, but they deal with kind of an all risks approach, all hazards approach as part of doing business. So when something goes wrong, they basically have muscle memory in terms of response. They just jump into response and they go. That's part of what, that's just the fabric of who they are. So there's actually quite a lot being done, and the challenge is there's not a lot of, I guess, publicly available disclosure of the efforts, because it's talking about security at, you know, critical infrastructure or utility installations. That's just not something you just share openly on a regular basis. So unfortunately, there's not a lot of, you know, clear communication about the good things that are going on, just because it's kind of sensitive, but there is a significant amount of work being done.
Thank you. Operator, are there any callers?
Yes, we do have a question from Dave Crafton. Your line is now open.
Yes, this question goes to the gentleman who was talking about the speed of development and how basically it's hard to protect stuff. I guess my question is, and it has to do with basically import-export as well as national security and homeland security, is that how do we ensure that the devices we're producing are, we are protecting those devices in this type of environment, to making sure they're not that the adversary, whoever that may be, whatever time of the day it is not getting our stuff and using it against us.
Yeah, great question. Supply chain security is the general topic this one falls under. You know, the best thing you can do, honestly, if you've already bought it, too late. You can try to detect, basically monitoring is the best thing you can do to detect for anything nefarious coming out, trying to get out of your network or out of your systems if you've already bought them. But the best approach is you use your dollars. You only buy products from vendors that have shown a degree of responsibility in the methods they use. I can think of a few equipment manufacturers in the critical manufacturing space that they have to buy chips, and they don't always, you know, get a choice on the countries from which the chips are available. But if they do buy chips from countries that are questionable, they literally unspool the entire set and run them all through an X-ray to make sure that every single one of them meets a specification, so that nothing's been added, for example. Some actually get code, and they escrow the source code, and they run the source code through checks. So the best thing you can do is ask your vendors what they do for their practices, and then use your money wisely and buy products from those vendors. Security as a differentiator is actually making a marketable difference now. So some organizations have like a white paper or a data sheet they'll give you on what they do and how they do it. But the more you ask, the more organizations will provide it. So unfortunately, you know, it's not a quick approach, but the most effective means is by using your dollars.
And this is Harley, just to jump on that one. I know, I think it was today or yesterday, DOD came out and started to limit the some types of cell phones that are available to overseas, you know, soldiers, airmen, sailors, because of this issue. So just search on that, and you'll be able to find out what vendors were blackballed.
Okay, thank
Operator,
you very much.
Operator, are there any more questions, calls?
I show no further questions.
Okay, well, I'll ask another one. And thank you, audience, for all the great questions. So here's another question for the group. So what are some best practices to securing legacy and SCADA systems?
This is Patrick. Isolation, obviously, is some of the best stuff you can do. Segmentation, isolation is great. Monitoring the networks is essential. Try to log as much as you possibly can. Aggregate the logs and look for anomalies. ICS is very difficult to secure because it's got to stay on. There are some cases where, you know, they argue that it's too critical to patch it, to take it down to patch it. There's the legacy stuff is the biggest challenge. There's, you know, like some refrigerator-sized RTUs out there that you can't sneeze by them because they're so critical and they're so prone to failure at the same time. I would say in most cases the best approach is going to be things like isolation and an extreme degree of monitoring. Whitelisting is a good way, even network-based whitelisting, where, you know, basically learn your network over time and know what is normal and alert on anything. In ICS, don't block anything because you never really know what that impacts will be, but alert on anything that looks anomalous. But if you're not looking, you're not going to know. So it's going to take, and in some cases, some commands are issued like, you know, once a quarter, once 6 months, once every year, or only in a certain condition state. So you'll need to, you know, basically take your time and set your boundaries on alerts, you know, tight at first and deal with the noise, and then narrow that down to what looks normal for your environment, and then alert on that. But isolation and monitoring, unfortunately, has so far been the most effective approach for the legacy stuff. Going forward, we've got all kinds of great new approaches, all the way up to and including virtualizing an entire power plant, for example, and then running, you know, capability scenarios on that. But in the legacy space, it's extremely challenging, and, you know, a lot of them take a hard line and say your best approach is to rip and replace. Not always feasible. So where you can't, then you're going to have to basically monitor like crazy and isolate to the best of your capability, restrict access. You know, isolation is not just in the network space, but in a physical security space as well. Know who has access to these things.
And so one last question as a follow-on is, so how should you manage vendors on a closed network?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
So the question was, how should you manage vendors on a closed network?
Someone else can take this
one. This is Harley. To that point and everything, what I think you're saying is, do you, you know, I would only open up the VPN on a case by case basis upon request, allow them to come in, and then you turn it off. If that's the question, you know, remote management of your vendors. The other thing is that there's a number of different external dependencies that you have to kind of take a look at nowadays with cloud services, et cetera. So one of the other things that we have is a thing called an EDM, which is externally dependency management assessment. And so consider you know, contacting us, and we may be able to assist in that area. But if the question is, you know, how do you manage vendors, I would say carefully.
Yeah, force them down the route of multi-factor authentication if you can. There's lots of ways to do that. Some of them, they're not technology-specific. Like I've seen some organizations using, like, the Google Authenticator, so that you don't have to force them down a specific technology path. They can use whatever they want with that. But multi-factor authentication has been key. We've seen some, like, blackouts in the Ukraine, and that came from, you know, outside access. Remote access was the way they got in. Vendor access is very challenging, especially when you've got like an open pipe. I'm thinking of things like the GE Data Highway or the Schneider Electric support network. There's a bunch of these ones where the vendors basically have open pipes. Those are dangerous, and they can be significant areas of risk. So I would agree. I don't have a silver bullet for that one. That one's extremely challenging, and it's very vendor specific. And some of them will void your warranty, or, you know, really mess with you from a support capability if you don't just jump through their hoops. So the best way I can think of is, you know, look at ways to actually ask them hard security questions, see what they come back with in terms of responses. Make it difficult for them as much as you possibly can within your contractual bounds. And whenever you renegotiate or purchase a new service, build some sort of strong authentication into the process so you can at least get some authenticity around who's getting in.
Awesome. Operator, were there any more calls?
Yes, we do have a question from James Aker. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm a small business in North Carolina, and there's a big concern that I have with open source tools. I know some of them get tested. I get the results of what's been tested. But is there a criteria that's being used to determine what open source tools are going through the test process and which ones that companies should stay away from? You know, I say this with the heels of what happened to Experian using something that, you know, breached a bunch of records. So that's generally my question. obviously open source has, you know, the cost advantage to me as a small business owner compared to, you know, having a large budget and buying commercial stuff. But if somebody could answer, what is the criteria, what is software that you can go look at a list and know that this open source software is being tested by Homeland or the NSA to know that it's safe for us to use in our enterprise?
That's a hard question also. Generally, open source is community controlled, if you will. And so there, even though there may be some governmental agencies that are taking a look at that, I don't believe that access or that specific list would be is currently shared, unless somebody else knows about it. But that's generally a community-based product. You're going to have to do some research and kind of look on the blogs and a few things like that to see if there's a lot of issues if you do not have an inside capability within your organization, and it does not sound like you do.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, this is Patrick. I'll add a real quick piece. It's open source, you know, it's great, it's free, it's kind of free like a puppy. So, you know, some of the best approaches I've seen is look for the number of patches that come out for the open source product. Typically, their capability to respond with a patch or an update is the best indicator of whether or not you're going to get, you know, some degree of support. Every piece of software, whether open source or closed source, can be vulnerable or likely already is vulnerable in many ways. So, you know, it's not a question of which one is more vulnerable than the other. It's a question of which one can deliver you patches, you know, fast enough for your business. So, as you know, from an open source perspective, look and see how fast they're patching, how quick and how frequently they patch, which will tell you the degree of so kind of open source support you're going to get for the product. And then the other side of that is what's your capability to actually implement that patch as soon as it comes out? Do you pay attention to the notices from your open source vendors as to when those patches come out, and when they do, you know, how fast can you get it applied?
Okay, and I guess the follow-on question would be, how much open source is used at the federal government level in Homeland Security or the NSA or any of the agencies that had speakers on today? Do they know that there's open source applications running in their enterprise and infrastructure?
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's all over the place. But, you know, organizations like Google and big airlines, and they everyone uses it everywhere. It's embedded in all kinds of things. Anyone who uses a Linux appliance is using an open source product. So it's pervasive. It's everywhere. It's not something that it's not like a number we could put on it, because it's almost, you could almost say 100% somewhere there will be an open source component. If it's not the entire suite or platform, it'll be an embedded element.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I show no further questions.
Okay, thank you so much. So, so with that, we're coming up on time for us to end the webinar. I certainly want to thank all of our audience for those absolutely fantastic questions. You've been a lively audience today, and we really appreciate you, you know, dialing in and asking those questions. And if we weren't able to get to your questions today, please send them to the CQ mailbox. We'll get them out to our panelists and see if we can get those questions answered for you. I'd like to, again, thank my co-hosts, Doug DePepe and Teresa Massey, and our panelists, Mark Dabena, Patrick Miller, and, of course, Harley Reinerson, our fantastic CSA that we have out there in the field, for joining us today and for contributing to such an informative discussion. And, again, to our audience, thank you so very much for tuning in. You definitely make these easy, and you make these great for us. Again, I highly encourage you to visit our website and sign up for our alerts and updates so you can stay on top of upcoming events and new resources. And if you have further questions or want to get involved, shoot us an email. Both email address and website should be currently being shown on the webinar slide. please take time out to do our survey. And thank you again for joining the C-Cube RC3 SLTTGCC webinar. And we hope to see you again real soon. And please have a great and safe afternoon.
This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for participating. You may disconnect at this time.